Welcome, friends. Welcome back to ArtCast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, bringing you architecture information from the edge, the cutting edge today of research. Yeah, today we're going to be listening to Andrew Herbert, who is the director of Microsoft Research in Cambridge. And these guys have just a really fun job. You know, talk about a fun job. You could just like pick any topic you want and go off and just noodle on it and think up the very cutting edge things that you're thinking about, problems that most people won't have to solve for 5 or 10 years, but you want to be on the edge. I think that would be so cool. Unfortunately, to qualify, I'd probably have to go back to school for a few years. Okay, so maybe I won't be there, but at least I get to talk to these guys. And maybe we can learn something by listening to the kind of problems they're solving at Microsoft Research. Let's give it up for Andrew Herbert!
Well, this is Ron Jacobs, and I'm back at the Architecture Insight Conference here at the Celtic Manor Resort in Wales, where I'm joined today by Andrew Herbert. And Andrew, you're with Microsoft Research here in the UK.
Absolutely. I run our lab in Cambridge. I'm the managing director.
Wow. And so a lot of people don't know about Microsoft Research, but we actually have a very significant investment in kind of this group of guys who is thinking about the future.
Absolutely. And research is an important part of Microsoft. It's about 750 researchers worldwide. They're all very smart people, PhDs. We've got 5 labs. Obviously, the main lab is the mothership in Redmond, like many things in Microsoft. The Cambridge lab I run was the first overseas lab. There's a lab in Beijing, which kind of looks after Asia, its area. We have a brand new lab in India that opened last year. And the kind of model for having multiple labs is, in each of those geographical areas, there's a talent pool of researchers we want to tap into. There are typically research topics that particularly resonate in that area. So, for example, in the UK, in Europe, there's been a long history of research in the design of programming languages and programming tools, and that's one of our particular strengths in Cambridge.
Wow, and so so you guys get to just choose some interesting topic and go at it? Is that how it works?
Absolutely. I was talking to people last night, and they're envious of my job. Bill and Steve send a check every year, and we choose our own agenda. We choose what we want to look at. The mission statement for research is really very simple. The first thing we do is advance the state of the art in our chosen areas of research. So that means we get to pick what we research. Obviously, we pick things that we think are going to be important and beneficial to Microsoft, either directly into the product groups or things that are going to help Microsoft think about new products or things that are going to be important to our customers and partners. We get to choose what those are. The way we measure how well we're doing in advancing the state of the art is we publish in the same kind of conferences that the leading academics from places like, you know, Cambridge University, MIT. We compete with those guys, if you like. In fact, we sometimes joke that in the same way the product group's ambition is market share in their product space, our aim is market share in academic publications, and we're kind of getting there.
And then eventually some of the ideas that you guys have been researching end up in products?
Absolutely, and that takes us to the second bullet in our mission statement, which is to make sure that the insights and the technology that come from our research are used to benefit the Microsoft product groups. And so inside research, as well as the researchers, we have a bunch of guys, our technology transfer team. They're doing the classic kind of program management activity that you find in a product group. They're looking to see what the product groups are doing, what their schedules are, what their needs might be. They know what our research technologies are, the things we've created in the past few years. And they look for opportunities to transfer those into the product groups, and then we'll set up a technology transfer product. And over the history of Microsoft Research, that every Microsoft product, I think, has been touched in some significant way or other by things that have come from research. Indeed, some of the Microsoft divisions today, like the Digital Media Division, actually grew up as incubations inside research.
Yeah, I remember when I was on the ComPlus team that we had a fellow from Microsoft Research who was with us for about 6 months, He was taking an idea that he had built in research and trying to actually drive it into real product.
And it turned out it didn't work. So
that's research.
I guess we learned something. Yeah. Well, it wasn't so much that it didn't work, but it was just going in a direction that the product wasn't going. And so in the end, we decided that, nah, this wasn't... It probably could have worked. That's what I should say.
Well, actually, one of the things that my boss, Rick Rashid, who's a senior VP of research, says to me is, you know, if everything I start succeeds, I'm not trying hard enough.
Yeah. You
know, research is about speculative, investigative stuff. It's not all going to work. And you know, some paths will go down. It might be great research. It might be great technology. But it's not the kind of stuff Microsoft's going to bring to market. And increasingly these days, we look for opportunities to license that out to partners, particularly if it fits a vertical market or to third parties. So yeah, and tech transfer, lots of ways of doing it. Sometimes it is, you know, the ideal case is we turn up with some papers and a prototype and a product group says yes and they put 10 guys on to picking that stuff up and the job is done. That's pretty rare, I have to say. At the other end of the spectrum is where some guys from research say, look, this is so important. We'll take time out from research and go and work with the product groups. So there have been a couple of examples from Cambridge. You might know in the common language runtime, there's a lot of support for what's called generic functions. There's a lot of tough stuff to do in the common language runtime to check any code you load to make sure it actually obeys the rules and can't screw up the system. That was done by people in Cambridge who spent 6 months in Redmond working with the CLR team to build that system. In fact, that's been an ongoing relationship. I've been with Microsoft just over 5 years now, and that team has been working with those product guys through, you know, the early design of the CLR, the multiple releases that have come through our products, staying with their technology, improving it all the time, helping the product group guys make best use of it.
Well, and I have to say, that is one of the most fantastic things to come along in the CLR. It's really just wonderful and what it enables.
It is, and I think, you know, there's an interesting new technology coming along which builds on top of that. One of the researchers who was very influential in the CLR work, a guy called Don Syme, has been building a new programming language called F#. You can download it from research.microsoft.com/F#. It's what in academic jargon is called a functional programming language. It's a programming language that is designed to do symbolic processing. So it's really great at working on arbitrary strings of stuff that you're trying to merge together. A lot of the kind of glueware we write today as we join different applications, it turns out to be very good at doing big scientific data processing tasks. My machine learning and perception group who do a lot of kind of classic AI type tools, which again have typically been very complex in the data they use and the calculations they do. They've been using this programming language, and it's turning out to be really great. People are saying they're able to write these very complex applications very quickly, process huge amounts of data very quickly, and that's really quite exciting. And it's kind of moving on from the C# world of objects to a much higher level of thinking about data flows and a more kind of declarative way of gluing software together. So I'm very excited about that.
So I guess that means that the world will advance beyond the realms of C# and Java in the future.
Absolutely. I think C# and Java, they were kind of languages of the 90s, and they've served us well. Now I think we're starting to think about what comes next. And if you look at computing, about every kind of 6 to 10 years, there's a shift in language paradigm, and we're due that one now. I think it takes 6 to 10 years, because that's how long it takes the authors to rewrite their textbooks, and that's kind of the controlling cycle.
Well, and you know, if once the books are all written, nobody's going to make any more money, so we need to get a new language so we can start all over again.
Absolutely, and I think we're kind of getting into that time frame.
Yeah. Okay, so you've been talking here about 21st century computing. And so here we are at the beginning of the 21st century. And you're thinking out longer term, though. Where do you see the trends taking us?
So really, I gave a talk after dinner last night. It was kind of a fairly short talk because it's getting late. But the central theme was, if I think about all the computing that I did in the 20th century, and I started as a kid programmer in the late 1960s, it was all about trying to squeeze as much out of the computer as you could. The memory wasn't big enough, the processor was too slow, the languages had all kind of limitations, and it was all about living with constraints. And if I look at computing today, then yeah, we have huge amounts of processing power. We're about to get multi-core architectures that will give us a lot more processing power, though rather different from the kind of single processor. We're on the threshold of, as individuals, carrying around a terabyte of personal data, which means all the data I ever create as a person, I can have with me on a simple device, all my music, all my pictures. I could, in fact, carry all my podcasts, you know, the entire audio history of my life. A terabyte's not quite enough to kind of carry around a video of your life, and you probably don't want to do that. So a huge amount of data. We have everything being interconnected by networking, and networking is getting cheaper. This is, you know, Moore's Law is really now working for us. And so we have to start thinking about computing not as what can we squeeze out of the systems, but really how can we exploit that richness. And that brings with it its own challenges. You know, with all that storage, finding things by giving them names and putting them in folders isn't going to work. There's too much stuff. So we want more kind of search-based metaphors. Simple kind of demonstrations I showed last night was, if you want to organize a collection of photographs, why don't you arrange that the folder gives you a collage of interesting pieces of the images out of that photograph collection? That's a really tough computer vision problem. You've got to recognize objects, join them together, but then it gives you a kind of visual summary. And I think there's a lot to be done in that kind of space. So there's, you know, there's opportunities because we have many more resources, many more things we can do. We perhaps don't have to worry so much about replicating and backing up data if everyone is carrying their own data with them and multiple copies. You know, how many of us have a laptop and a PDA and a phone and other devices, all of which carry our data? So backup perhaps isn't the question. What the problem has moved to is consistency. They may not be exact copies of each other. How do I take advantage of that? How do I find things?
Nick, my big problem is, as you get more and more digital assets, but you change computers, every so often, and it seems like in the process of changing computers, you always lose some. You didn't get all of the music copied or all of the pictures copied, or you lose a hard drive and there goes all your digital assets. But just backing them all up is, because of the sheer volume, is an enormous pain. So that's my big problem anyway.
It is. I think that problem's going away. And if you look at the size of a PC disk today, it's pretty big. Most people's disks are probably only half full of data, and the half that's full of data, 80% of that is actually the operating system and the applications. there are people with large collections of music and so forth. But I was in the States last week. I bought a 2 GB memory stick. I think it cost me $90. And that's a huge amount of storage. It's not my entire collection. So I will certainly expect 5-10 years from now to be buying terabyte memory sticks. And that's certainly more than enough data. So as a researcher, I'm thinking about that future world and how technology will work in that environment.
Yeah, It is pretty good. I mean, I did buy a rather large USB disk, external disk for my home computer. I set it up with the new Windows OneCare backup thing, so it automatically backs up the whole thing. Because my kids are out there, I mean, daily, they're buying songs at 99 cents a pop. And it was funny because not too long ago, we got a virus on our home computer, and I never was able to identify what it was. But this thing was really nasty because it would cause the computer to reboot every so often. And when you could get the computer up, this virus had somehow blocked all paths to getting at the data. You couldn't do any network access. It blocked any drives. You couldn't put a memory stick in. You couldn't transfer files in any way possible. But I finally was able to bring up the computer in safe mode with a command prompt and then use the command line to save those precious music collections because this silly thing had gotten onto me.
So some of those 20th century hacking skills are still required in the 21st century.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it makes me wonder where the attackers are going to go in the 21st century.
So, and that's another area of research that's quite important to us in Cambridge. One of our projects is called Vigilante. What we've been looking at is the problem of worm attacks. And as you know, they propagate really very, very quickly. So by the time someone's detected them, it's too late. It takes companies several days to find a fix. By then, the entire internet is infected, and it's a really miserable experience. Most of the technology today that's trying to find worms is essentially based on monitoring the network and looking for unusual properties, and that doesn't work terribly well. You put a new application in your system, the network monitoring says, that's a worm, and so it shoots down the new application. That's not what you want. The guys who design and write these worms, they're quite good at kind of building stealth worms that fit into the regular patterns so that the detection tools don't pick them up. So we decided to look at it much more from an operating systems and a network perspective, which is what you might expect inside Microsoft. And we said, what is it that goes on inside the operating system when a worm is attacking it? And usually what is going on is at some level in the system, someone is executing as instructions data that came in off the network. So using a bunch of stuff, some of the virtualization technology Microsoft has, a number of other techniques, we essentially built a version of Windows that can detect when that happens. And so we monitor every network packet coming into the machine. We track that data as it goes through the operating system. And if we find someone trying to execute that data, we say, that's a worm. That gives you the detection mechanism. On top of that, we then analyze the packets that cause that worm attack. We can, from that, automatically generate a filter. And so we've built the detection system. We've built a kind of peer-to-peer content distribution system for flashing out a warning about the worm. Now, that's an interesting challenge, because if there's a worm attack going on, people are kind of very suspicious about messages they might receive. So we've arranged what we send out are called self-certifying alerts. What we do is we send essentially a sample of the network packets that contain the attack and a description of the effect they will cause. So you can verify in your machine, yes, those packets cause that effect. So you've effectively confirmed for yourself the worm attack. And we send a patch or a fix, which again we can compute dynamically because we know what kind of packets we're trying to shoot down. We've built that as a research prototype. It actually won the best paper prize at the major academic operating systems conference back in last October. And we're doing an incubation of kind of trying to build an industrial scale version of it to see how it really stands up in practice.
That's a fantastic idea, because in fact, on one of my previous ArtCasts, I did with Keith Brown, who's a well-known security expert, we were talking about this concept of the confusion between data and executable instructions is almost always going to lead to big security problems, you know.
Absolutely.
And, it made me think, you know, it seems like there ought to be a way at a very, very core level where we could keep these two things very segregated. Maybe it has to happen down in the processor architectures or something. I don't know. I'm in way over my head when I start talking about this. But it seems like, there needs to be a very solid distinction between these two things, and yet it's so easy for them to become intermingled in the current architectures.
It is, and I can blame Intel for that. The early Intel memory architectures didn't distinguish between code and data segments, whereas classic mainframe minicomputer architectures did. We now have that capability in the more modern versions of their memory architecture. It's the no execute protection, NX, and Windows supports that. The problem is there are some applications that have been used to operating the world where code and data are mixed, and so not all the applications work if you switch on the NX protection. The nice thing about the Vigilante system is, since it's tracking data that comes off the network, those applications that are patching code and data, well, the application is fine. It doesn't shoot those down because they're not working off network data. They're working off their own data, and that's not a worm. So we can kind of put the two techniques together. The other stuff which is, I think, going to help is the increasing use of virtualization. So that you're effectively running multiple copies of the operating system on the processor. And certainly as we go multi-core and with the new memory architectures and virtualization architectures the hardware vendors are providing, we're kind of, I think, head to a world where we think about running each application almost on its own operating system and breaking out the file system as a separate subsystem. That then means if there is a problem, you've got rather more control, and you may just have to, you may lose one application, but you don't lose the whole machine. And that's certainly where operating systems researchers are looking, is how we can exploit the hardware mechanisms better. And yeah, it is an operating system question. There's a lot we can do if we improve the programming languages in which we write our operating system. There's a project in the Redmond Lab, and some of my people are partnering with them, called Singularity, that's building an operating system using C# from the ground up. And they've kind of added a lot of extensions to C# so you can prove the correctness of how one bit of the operating system calls another. So you've got a kind of provable operating system. That's much more robust. So you put all those techniques together, and I think future generations of operating systems will be a lot better defended against worm and virus attacks.
Well, and I think the other thing that the virtualization could do for us is help with, I don't know what to call it, but there's a phenomenon that when you get a new PC, works great at first, and then you start adding one program and another program and more drivers and more little gizmos running in your tray, and before you know it, you look at the task manager and there's 100 processes running from many, many different companies, and your computer is getting slower and slower and unstable, and you just don't know what's going on. And it becomes very, very difficult to try to reverse this trend. So eventually you just give up and reinstall Windows and start over again.
Absolutely. So in research, we call that regrooving our machines, and you kind of do it every year.
Yeah.
So virtualization will help a lot with that. And it kind of threads us back to the conversation we were having a few moments ago. You were talking about the difficulty of carrying forward data, also old applications. I think, you know, as we build up our digital repositories, some formats will fall out of date. Some things we'll choose to convert. For some stuff, we'll want to keep old versions of operating systems, old applications, and be able to run those, but in a very protected bubble. And I think virtualization will help us with that. People are doing it in the enterprise today. They're partitioning up their big servers and running older versions of NT or whatever for some apps that they haven't moved into the new environments yet. I think we'll see a lot more of that.
Yeah, and that actually would be very useful. But when it comes down to it, it's actually sometimes very hard to find an old copy of the operating system just to test on it. I recall a while back we were looking for Windows 98. Even in Redmond, it's very hard to find a disk of Windows 98.
Absolutely. Makes life kind of difficult. And one of the projects we're doing, we've been talking a lot with the British Library here in the UK. Obviously, they're... Up until now, they've been collecting paper and parchment and physical artifacts. They're increasingly getting digital artifacts. One of the things they've been promised when our Prime Minister finally retires and steps down, they'll get his digital archive, his email, his documents, and so forth. And their question to us is, great, we're going to get all this stuff. How do we store it? And then how does someone access it 100 years from now when it probably isn't going to be Windows XP? Vista should have shipped by then, we hope. Yeah, so there's a real challenge.
That is a big challenge because, for years I have kept a 3.5-inch floppy that contains the very first commercial software I ever wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure, for one, I can't hardly find a computer that has a 3.5-inch floppy drive anymore. And for two, I'm not sure that the disk would read if I put it in there because it's those things age pretty quickly as well. So when you think about even a CD or a DVD, 100 years from now, you might be very hard to find a device that will read that.
Absolutely. And DVDs don't actually last that long either. They delaminate and the surface falls off. So the only answer is actually the stuff needs to be online and being kind of continually massaged and moved forwards. And it's something Microsoft is thinking about. We're doing a lot of work with the OpenXML people looking at Office standards and what that means about evolving those formats going forwards. So that's part of the work we're doing with a consortium of libraries. There are kind of two approaches. And you either have to keep, as it were, massaging the formats and moving them forwards, which is a kind of process-based approach. Or you go down this virtualization approach and you kind of keep virtual archives of previous processor architectures and roll those forwards. And I think we'll find a mix of those techniques. I've got all the data back from when I did my thesis in 1978, and that's completely unreadable because the machine is now in a museum. I keep thinking about writing an emulator so I can see if the code still runs and stuff, but you don't want to be spending your life doing that.
Yeah. One thing I'm curious about is the next big breakthrough that will totally transform computing. So we've seen sort of a long stream of incremental improvement of processor architectures. And the improvement's been dramatic, but it's been essentially the same idea, just cramming more and more transistors and that sort of thing. And I read recently about some of the research that's going on in the areas of quantum physics and whatnot. And I began imagining, do you think that will have something to do with the next kind of big breakthroughs?
So breakthroughs are really hard because actually you see them afterwards. And things that people think of as big breakthroughs, like the switch to Windows and mice and so forth, sure, that kind of gelled in the work that Xerox PARC did. But if you look behind that, there was 20 years of people working on display technologies, different kinds of input-output technologies that kind of finally gelled in a format. Everyone went, yes, now it works. So I think there's a number of technologies that we're probably in the middle of developing that at some point will be declared a breakthrough as all the pieces come together. For the long-range stuff, and we do some of that in Microsoft Research, there are people looking at quantum computing. It's very hard to predict when that would actually turn up as kind of quantum computers you buy in the shops and what you would buy a quantum computer in the shop for. Today, the applications are very specialized. Quantum computing is great for certain kinds of mathematical problems like searching for crypto keys. There's some work that I'm doing with some colleagues looking at biological models of computing. And if you think of biological systems, they replicate, they grow, they're intelligent, and they sound really rather better than silicon systems. So what can we learn from biology? I don't think we'll see a green soup computer in the shops in the next 10 years, but I think doing research in that area, we'll learn a lot that could inform about how we think about our own software systems. And interestingly, there are things that we're doing for silicon computers that are helping the biologists. One of my colleagues, Luca Cardelli, is interested in mathematical models of software to prove correctness of complex software systems, has used some of that maths to model biological systems at the cell level. And biologists don't have maths. Physics is all maths. Chemistry is all maths these days. The biologists are still kind of exchanging little pictures with each other. So he's taken some of our programming methodologies, used them to describe biological systems, and has made quite good progress in having effectively programs that describe biological processes. He's had to kind of add some extra stuff to the mathematics, and in fact, that stuff is useful for solving some of his software problems too. And so I think we're seeing a convergence there between computing ways of modeling things and biological ways of modeling things, and that may well accelerate the opportunities for bringing ideas from the biological world into the computing world.
I can just imagine the day when I will have to feed my computer.
Absolutely. Well, you do today. You kind of feed it plastic, don't you? Those CDs and whatever. And I think you've got to kind of think about the process. And the early objectives for work like this will be things like, can we have a computer model of the human immune system? And then think about how that will revolutionize the way the drug companies think about drugs and drug testing. You may know there's been a kind of a big issue in the UK in the last week about some drug trials that went wrong and some people were very seriously ill. How much of that testing can you actually move to a computer simulation environment? If you have that model of the immune system, think about the kind of personal healthcare applications that could be built when you combine it with some of the stuff that's going on with sensors and mobile communication. That, I think, would change the way medicine is delivered, and there are huge IT opportunities in that space. And then looking further out, once we understand the human immune system, what ideas from there can we transfer back into software systems that kind of just brings us back to viruses and worms again?
It is very interesting. Well, I what got me thinking about this was I read recently that researchers had I don't know if it can even do it justice to describe what the article said, but they had basically looked at using quantum physics to do communications between endpoints. And it was communication in such a way that it could not be intercepted or eavesdropped on, because of the very, if you did intercept it, you would alter the whole quantum state. And so, that would be absolutely fantastic if it could be developed.
So that's actually up and running. There's a quantum network running in Boston in Massachusetts. So, and what's actually going on there, the classic problem in network security is distributing the keys, because until everyone has the secret key, there's no way you can have the secure communication. And that distribution process has always been the weak link. because if you try and distribute the keys over the network itself, that's an opportunity for someone to try and steal them. If you rely on processes that don't work over the network, then you've got a huge management cost of how do you get the keys out there. And anyone who's trying to set up a PKI infrastructure knows that's really hard. What the quantum methods let you do is pick and distribute keys, and indeed it has this property that if someone else steps into the process, the quantum maths works against you, and you know that you know someone's trying to steal the key, and so there's no point using a key that's been compromised, so it's useless to other people. And that's a very powerful result. I think that will be one of the first applications that you'll see in quantum computing, networking hardware that does quantum key distribution.
That is really amazing. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, so if you do my job, you not only have to know something about computing, you have to be able to talk to biologists about cell biology, you have to talk to physicists about quantum effects and kind of join all that stuff together. It makes it a pretty exciting job.
Yeah, I guess so. Wow, well, thank you so much for taking the time to fill me in on Microsoft Research.
Absolute pleasure. Good to talk to you.
All right. Andrew Herbert, everybody. Microsoft Research guy. Wow. Can you wait for a quantum computer? I mean, I think that would just be so cool. When we get away from, just the same old model that we've been using for 50, 60 years and do something radically different. Anyway, that's kind of the weird things I think about. And some of you like it, though, because here's a nice mail from Matt, who's in Queensland, Australia. I love Cairns down there. He said he just started listening to ArtCast and he loves them. They're always interesting. We have great guests and he learns a lot. Hey, thanks, Matt. What do you think? Send me a note to ron.jacobs@microsoft.com and let me know, because I'm always interested to hear what you're thinking about the show. And we'll keep bringing them here on ArtCast.